to the Worship Institute, so I'm happy to be co-sponsoring this event. I'm going to open with prayer in a minute, and then my plan is I want to talk a little bit about the Gospel of John, and Mark, rather. I gave some lectures to some preachers in Iowa last spring, and we settled down there to hear about the Gospel. So I actually made presentations like this on each of the Gospels. Last year here at Symposium, I did the one on Matthew, because last year in the lectionary, if you're a lectionary preacher, it was a Matthew year. This is more of a Mark year. Do Luke next year. The idea is I just kind of want to give and a lot of this is going to be a review from seminary, if you're a preacher or whatever, but just sort of a bird's eye review, a reminder of some of the salient features of Mark, things that I think preach well in Mark, things that I think that if you're going to do a sermon series for Mark, you would want to be sure to bring out as motifs, and maybe some of the challenges of Mark and opportunities of Mark, and we'll talk about that, and certainly feel free to ask questions all along the way. I hope that there'll be some time near the end for some questions as well. But let me open with a word of prayer. We're thankful for a sunny day in January in Michigan, Lord. We're thankful for blue skies and for pleasant temperatures, and though some maybe wished to see more snow, we're also grateful that the weather isn't making getting around campus or getting to and from Grand Rapids difficult this year. So we're grateful for that. We're grateful for everybody who's here, for every person who has come from across the globe or across town. We're grateful for all the presenters. We're grateful for the worship services that have been taking place and will continue to take place the next 36 hours or so. Bless each and every one of those things, and may all of us who are here to participate, may we all go home energized and enthused for our task. We pray for this session as well. Bless our conversation together and our learning through Christ our Lord. Amen. Okay, so just a few things that you know that I think most of you know about Mark, just generally, right? Mark is the shortest gospel, as you know. It's pretty much shortest in every way. Fewest number of chapters, and so forth, fewest number of words, total word count. So it's short compared to the other three Gospels. Most, not all, you can't get an all on any of such questions, but most scholars do go with what they call the priority of Mark. They do think Mark was probably the first written down sometime later in the first century. As you know, the epistles were probably written and mailed out by Paul and James and John and others well before the Gospels were ever put down. So Mark, generally believed to have been written first, and was probably known to all of the other Gospel writers. Certainly Matthew and Luke, as you may remember from seminary days, all but 31 verses of Mark's Gospel occurs in Matthew, Luke, or both. So there are only 31 verses in Mark that are not duplicated in either Matthew, Luke, or both, which leads some people to scholars to believe that indeed Matthew and Luke knew Mark and drew off of Mark when they wrote their Gospels. Some people think that Peter may have been the dictator, that he had dictated the Gospel to Mark, that Peter was perhaps a key source for whoever Mark was, because there are lots of details in here that probably only Peter could have known. And so there's been some speculation that Mark was sort of the amanuensis, the secretary for Peter. Not sure about that either. That's just sort of the textual background that you know. But there are a number of things in Mark that, despite the fact that Matthew and Luke clearly knew of Mark and seem to have used Mark, there's a lot of things nevertheless. I mean, because Matthew and Luke each shaped their own gospel, they had some of their own material. They may have had access to the alleged Q document as well. But there's a lot of things about Mark that don't really get replicated in Matthew or Luke, or certainly in John. So I just want, like I said, want to just talk about some of the things that make Mark interesting and unique, and some of the things I think that can even be fun to bring out in preaching. The first thing to know about Mark, of course, is that how abruptly it begins, and eventually we'll talk about how very, very abruptly it ends. If Mark were a movie, there wouldn't be any opening credits. If Mark were a musical, there wouldn't be an overture. And if Mark were a sermon, there wouldn't be an opening illustration. Mark really just takes off like a rocket. Mark takes off like a Roman candle. In fact, in just the first 13 verses alone, Mark covers an incredible amount of ground. Mark, of course, didn't see any need for Christmas. God bless him. You know, when you think about it. Anyway, Matthew obviously has a little bit about Jesus' birth. There's really a few verses involving Joseph and Mary and the angel. John has kind of the cosmic perspective on Christmas, right? With the opening prologue and so forth. Luke, of course, gives us almost everything that we associate with Christmas. Mark gives us absolutely nothing about what we might associate with Christmas or where Jesus comes from. He just appears literally out of nowhere through the vapory mists emanating off the desert floor, and there he is, and we just have to deal with him. So Mark is very, very different. And again, the first 13 verses, right? So it's interesting. If you look at the Gospels, right, from the beginning of the Gospel, from the opening line of the Gospel to Jesus, like, say, first sermon, right, to the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, in Luke, that requires 3,800 words in most English translations. So you're going to read 3,800 English words in Luke before Jesus really gets his ministry going in Luke chapter 4. Matthew, you read about 1,500 words before you get to the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Mark gives us 280. Right? So Mark is just taking off so very, very quickly. Mark seems to be in a very big hurry to get Jesus in front of us and to get us face to face with Jesus, who Mark tells us right in his opening verse is the Son of God. This is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and we're going to get right to it. And that is going to be characteristic of Mark, and I think it's something that gives us an opportunity as preachers, insofar as we can when we preach on Mark, to bring out some of that drama and to bring out some of that urgency, really, that Mark has in his presentation. Some literary characteristics of Mark that we can talk about. It tends to be highly episodic. We just keep moving from one thing to the next without much breathing space, without a lot of reflection time. It tends to be very, very, very episodic with a real emphasis on action, and on drama. And part of that, some of you may remember or you know already, part of that is comes in, you know, Mark's favorite adverb of elthus, you know, immediately. Absolutely everything happens immediately in Mark's gospel. In fact, if you have a Bible with you or whatever, if you look in Mark 1 alone, right? So we get the opening, we get John the Baptist, and then off we go. He gets baptized down in verse 9. In verse 10, Jesus comes up out of the water. And, of course, this doesn't always come across in English translations, unfortunately. We lose a lot of this drama of Mark. But Jesus comes up out of the water in verse 10, and immediately the heavens are torn open, and a dove descends upon him. And then you get to verse 12, and immediately, Elphinus, the Spirit, sends him out into the desert. I'll talk about it in a moment. And he's with the wild animals. And then you go down, Jesus starts preaching, and you get to verse 18, and Jesus calls the first disciples, come follow me. And in Mark 1:18, immediately they left their nets, and they followed him. And then they go a little farther, and see the sons of Zebedee. And immediately he calls them, and they start to follow him. In verse 21, they went to Capernaum, and immediately Jesus went into the synagogue and began to teach. And then just one verse later, verse 23, and immediately a man in the synagogue, possessed by an evil spirit, cried out, and Jesus delivers them. And then news of that spreads, and in verse 28, and immediately word of Jesus spreads all over Galilee. And then the very next verse, and then immediately he left the synagogue and went with James and John to their house. And Simon's mother was in bed and so forth. Then he keep going down in 42. He heals a man with leprosy. Immediately the man is cured. And then immediately Jesus sends him away with a strong warning. I mean, we're kind of flying along here. Really what you get here is you get that adverb elthus. And this is just chapter one. You get that adverb elthus used 10 times in 25 verses. Basically every other verse. And that is just typical of Mark. He is really, really telling this story, and the speed with which it happens is a big characteristic of Mark's style and of his enthusiasm I remember we had a high school math teacher, who was just a very enthusiastic person in every way. And I worked on the student newspaper. I was a senior, and he wrote a guest column for us. Every single sentence ended with an exclamation mark. I mean, every sentence. There wasn't a period or a question mark to be seen. Because that's just who he was. He was just this bubbly, effervescent guy. And that's kind of how Mark was. Just this bubbly, effervescent guy. He's just, man, things are just taking off. It's quite amazing. Partly because of that fast action, characters in Mark tend to be a little bit flat. Mark isn't the place to go where you want to hear a given person's interior monologue with themselves. You're not going to get it. You're not going to get a lot of background of a lot of characters. People tend to come and go rather quickly. And that can be true to a certain degree of all the Gospels. But it certainly is true of Mark, that people come and go pretty quickly. Now, that also, I think, gives, in a way, your own preaching opportunity to let your imaginations be disciplined by the text. You can go crazy, but you can imagine a little bit more about what people thought, where they came from, how they encountered Jesus, and so forth and so on. And, of course, that's true just generally. In one of the seminars I took in, I think it may have been Gary Burge yesterday, here on the Gospel of John, but it's a well-known fact of all the Gospels, and it is true of Mark as well, that you almost never know, and Marianne Mai Thompson was saying this also today, you never really know how something gets said in the Bible. I mean, most of the time the Bible uses says, answered, reply, not screamed, shrieked, smirked. Not he said dryly, or she said wittily, or he said sarcastically. You just don't get that stuff. And so you have to imagine the acoustics sometimes. And sometimes doing that creatively, taking your cues from the text itself. I mean, we can't imagine Jesus said certain things just any old way, but he said it somehow. I mean, despite those Jesus movies in the 70s, you know, where Jesus was whacked up on Thorazine for his whole life, just trying to talk like this. He was a real human being, and people generally like being around him, so I assume he didn't talk like that, because that's the kind of guy you walk away from quietly with no sudden movements. So Jesus said everything somehow, and characters reacted somehow, but we're not always told. And that actually is a preaching imaginative opportunity to help enter even really familiar texts in new ways. But again, as I said, for Mark, drama and vivid action is key. And again, unfortunately, you either need to know Greek and check it when you preach on Mark, or you need a really good commentary or a Bible software program that can help you, because a lot of some of the most dramatic things that happen in Mark's gospel, you just don't see in English translation. Mark is really, really on fire here, and he really, really is very dramatic here, but you're going to miss a lot of it if you only rely on translations, which may or may not bring that across. And so I'll just give you a few for instances, but there are a lot of them. In Mark 1, verse 10, I just mentioned it, the baptism of Jesus. As Jesus comes up out of the water, we're told that the heavens are torn asunder, schizane, God tearing open the heavens there and sending down the Spirit. It's a very, very dramatic scene. It's not just sort of a quiet little zipper, you know, that God's just unzipping the heavens there and letting the dove out. This is, you know, tearing open the heavens. And then, in what I think is one of the most egregious examples of a bad translation, and you see it all over the place, two verses later, you know, you always read, and then the Spirit sent Jesus into the wilderness. It's like the Spirit came down and gave Jesus an engraved wedding invitation. You know, dearest Jesus, the Father would have you go to the wilderness next. Sent Jesus into the wilderness. And there you go. The verb there is ekbale, right? Which means to hurl, to throw with force, right? And I've always said, if you want a picture, remember some of those old westerns you've seen where somebody in an old a saloon in Dodge City gets drunk and a bouncer comes and just throws him through the plate glass window out and tumbles out into the street? That's it. That's the idea. The Spirit hurls Jesus into the wilderness. I've often used the image that it's almost as though, so we're told that the Spirit descended like a dove, but it's almost as though at the last minute the Spirit transmogrifies into like some fierce-looking hawk who picks Jesus up in his sharp talons and throws him, hurls him right out into the desert wastes. And that is the drama there, and sent, to put it mildly, doesn't even begin to capture it. Mark, while we're on that real quick, well, I'll come back to that in just a second. A couple more things. I'll come back real quick. Mark 1:24, a little bit farther in Capernaum, and there's this demon-possessed man who shrieks out to Jesus. And in Greek, it's anakraxe. It even sounds dramatic. Anakraxe. He shrieks. I'd imitate it for you, but I have to preach again in the morning. I don't want to rip up my vocal cords. But, I mean, it is a, you know, gullet-piercing scream and shriek by this demon-possessed man. Anakraxe. Mark liked colorful verbs. Mark 3, verse 10, we're told that the crowds, you usually read the crowds were kind of pressing in on Jesus. There were a lot of crowds. But again, the Greek there is epipiptane, which is usually the word that you use for falling from a great height, you know, like some great boulder that somebody shoved off a cliff, and it's epipiptane. It's crashing down. It's as though the crowds were crashing in around Jesus. I mean, they weren't just, you know, crowded and jostling like on a crowded elevator. They're just epipipting. They're tipping into him. They're rushing headlong into Jesus, heeling over into him. Mark 6 again. We got another example. Mark 6:49 of someone screaming, and again it's anakraxe. You know, just that, you know, gizzard piercing screaming that's going on. And then, you know, Mark also likes other colorful stories. So you've got sort of the weirdest healing story of them all, you know, in Mark 7, where Jesus, you know, puts his fingers in the man's ears, you know, and it's like, what is going on? Why didn't you just say, you know, be healed? Mark's got Jesus doing all these weird little things with his fingers and his spit, and but very dramatic. Very dramatic. So the drama of Mark is important. Now, there are different theories as to some of this. I've just got one possibility up here, but there's a lot of question about who was Mark's audience. All the gospel writers seem to have a certain audience in mind. Matthew, we're pretty sure, were Jews or Jewish Christians or Jews that Matthew was trying to convince. Was the Messiah that they had been waiting for. Luke, more of a Greek audience, addressing it to Theophilus, and so forth. Less sure about Mark's intended audience. Who did Mark have in mind? Some people think maybe he was trying to wake up a lethargic church community. That's, some scholars think that might be the case, that maybe they forgot how much power there is in Jesus. And so he's going to get in their faces in these stories and use these colorful, vivid, dramatic verbs to remind them church isn't supposed to be just some nice little button-down, polite place. It is set loose with the power of the Holy Spirit. Others think, and it still works almost the same, others think Mark was comforting a persecuted church. that the church, his church community, perhaps in the first century, a church community he knew of, was under great duress. And the powers that be, the powers of the world, seemed to have the upper hand. And so maybe Mark is saying, no, Jesus has the upper hand. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. Mark didn't write that, but he could have. That is possible as well. Either way, you know, waking up a church that had forgotten how much power there is in Jesus, or comforting a church that was in duress by reminding them again how much power there is in Jesus. This really is the Son of the living God set loose in our world, and we don't want to forget about that. Before we move on from that, also just want to loop back to the baptism story and then that hurling of Jesus into the desert wastes. Again, either way for whoever Mark's community might have been. Mark, of course, needless to say, as we just saw, you know, he uses 280 words, where Matthew, you know, Luke took 3,800 words to get us to the same point in the gospel. Mark's a minimalist, right? He's a minimalist. He's going to say a lot, and you'd better pay attention to the words he uses, because he's not going to take extra time to explain it all to you. He's going to figure, you're going to figure it out. And you should know this from knowing the Hebrew scriptures, the Tanakh, the Old Testament. You should know this. And so Mark, and again, one of the reasons Mark can get us to the first sermon of Jesus in 280 words instead of 3,800 words or 1,800 words is he just doesn't tell us a lot of this stuff. So Jesus goes to the wilderness. He's tempted by the devil. Well, you know, we get three temptation stories in Luke and in Matthew, and we get all the details and so forth. Not Mark, right? He was impelled into the wilderness, where he was tempted by Satan. He was with the wild animals, and angels attended him. That's it. Right. That's Mark's temptation story. Wow. Why would that perhaps be encouraging to a persecuted church or wake up a lethargic church? Well, because you got to read it right, right? You got to read it right. Jesus is baptized. God declares him his beloved son, right? That's good news. We'd all like that. But then you immediately find out what is the Son of God. You go straight to the place of chaos. Because all through Scripture, of course, wilderness is chaos. Right? In Genesis 1, before God imposes cosmos on the chaos, everything is tohu vabohu. Waste, form, and void. Right? Tohu vabohu. And that, my favorite Hebrew phrase, the only Hebrew phrase I know, but that Hebrew phrase, tohu vabohu, in the rest of Scripture becomes synecdoche for the wilderness. For the place of uncreation, where the devil runs wild and the demons howl and the wild animals roam, and it's the dangerous place. The wilderness is tohu vabohu. It is the chaos that made a comeback on cosmos when sin and evil entered the creation. Therefore, if you're God's beloved son, who's the Messiah, that's the first place you have to go. You have to go straight at chaos. You have to go straight at the wilderness. That's where you start. And that's also why in the prophets, you know, quoted all through the Gospels, in the desert, proclaim the good. In the wilderness, build a highway for our God. It's got to start where things are at their worst, if things are ever going to get better. And that's what the wilderness was. And the wilderness was feared, and it was dangerous, and all through the Old Testament, it was the place to avoid. But it was also the place that Isaiah and the other prophets said that when Messiah comes, when the kingdom comes, the desert will bloom. And instead of, you know, the myrtle, the pine tree will grow. And then Isaiah's great vision of the peaceable kingdom, where the lion will lie down with the lamb, and the child will play by the hole of the adder, and no one will either harm or destroy in all my holy mountain. Right? Of course, it's Woody Allen said, the lion will lie down with the lamb, but the lamb won't get much sleep. But that's the image. And that's what Mark is doing here. In just a handful of Greek words, he was with the wild animals, but they didn't hurt him. And angels attended him. It's Isaiah's holy mountain. It's the peaceable kingdom, all in just a couple words. That's how powerful Jesus is. Where Jesus goes, cosmos follows. Right? Chaos retreats. Cosmos comes back, and we have a new Genesis. A new beginning, a new creation. And Mark does all of that so very, very quickly you could miss it, right? He does all of that so very, very quickly that you could miss it. And yet, there's a sense in which also by not giving us all the three specific temptations you can get in Matthew or Luke, we also aren't distracted by all of that jump off the temple stuff and all that stuff. We're just really focused on the main thing. And the main thing is that God's Son came to start rolling back evil. And the church today, here's your sermon application, the church today, where do we go? Where we have to start, you know, in the crack house, in the heroin-infested neighborhoods, in the prisons, in the places of chaos today. That's where he had to go. That he went first. So Mark is speedy. Mark is dramatic. Mark uses colorful language. Mark doesn't slow down for anybody, and he's really showing us the power of God. Those are some of the, and he's a minimalist, and you're really, in the minimalism, though, he packs a lot. And we'll see another example of that before I conclude in a little while. The other great thing about Mark that you know, it's just something to pay attention to. Whether it always works to draw this out in preaching, I don't know. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But it's good for you to know in the study, at least, as you study these things. And that is, the intercalation, or what are known as Mark and sandwiches. Right? Mark loves taking two semi-related stories and then sandwiching something else in between them, and then the two related stories not only cast light on each other, like the top piece of bread, the bottom piece of bread in the sandwich, but also prospectively and retrospectively help you to interpret what comes in the middle of the sandwich as well. And there's lots of different examples of this. If you can go to Mark 3, 20 to 35, Jesus is being accused of being in league with Beelzebub, and then Mark also throws in, some accusations of his own family, and he juxtaposes those to get at the theme that Jesus was opposed, and conflict and misunderstanding is a key theme of Mark, and so he'll take accusations from the authorities, accusations from or questions about his family, and he kind of just sandwiches those together. Or the real classic one is in Mark 5, 21 to 43, because here you've got a dead girl and a sick woman, right? So you've got a woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, a little child who has died at the age of 12 years. Both of them have, are now, the woman for 12 years has been ritually unclean, can't really come into the community. The child, by virtue of being dead, has become unclean now. But we've got two tragedies involving two women. One, a woman who has, been ostracized, and another, a child who has died too young and left her family bereft. And you've got, in between there, Jewish authorities arguing about what's clean and what's unclean. And so Mark, sandwiches these things together to say, where Jesus goes, cleanliness follows. So the woman touches Jesus. And of course, this is also a scene where there are lots of people crowding in. Do you think that Jesus is the only person that this woman touched or was touched by? Right. Technically, she made unclean everybody in that crowd who bumped into her shoulder or saw her. And yet Jesus heals her. He doesn't ostracize her. He heals her. Because where Jesus goes, cosmos follows. Right. Jesus doesn't become unclean by touching the unclean. They become clean. The little girl, Jesus doesn't become unclean by touching a corpse. She lives. She comes back to life. And meanwhile, the Jewish authorities can debate till they're blue in the face what is clean and unclean, but the one who makes all clean is right here. You also have in Mark 6 and then into Mark 7, you have this this interesting sandwich about, on the one hand, Jesus sending out the 12 for their first mission, and then the told out of sequence tale of the beheading of John the Baptist, which had happened before. Right, but so Mark tells it out of chronological order because he's reminding us of the cost of discipleship, of persecution. You're going to go out, you're going to do great things, you disciples. Oh, but by the way, I'm going to sandwich that with the beheading of John the Baptist just to remind you that the world is going to reject those who represent me. Did John, it will you. And so Mark, Mark tells that story out of sequence for that literary, for that very literary reason. In fact, it's interesting, when you read John 6, and we're told that John the Baptist is in prison, we're going to do that, then people were starting to ask about Jesus, and then Herod says, you know, oh, this, I think it's John the Baptist raised from the dead. Now, if you're reading Mark for the first time, and you get to that, you go, Dad, I didn't even know he was sick. What do you mean he's dead? What happened? Oh, Mark says. Oh, yeah, it happened this way. So he moves it out. And there are other ones, too. Another one in 11, obviously you got the sandwich of the cleansing of the temple and the cursing of the fig tree. A really curious incident with the fig tree, pointing to the spiritual deadness of Israel in Jesus' day, symbolized by both the temple and the fig tree. And there's a few more. But that's always something to watch for in Mark, that he'll take two related incidents and bring them into proximity, sometimes even when they aren't chronologically related, in order to make a larger point. And then, of course, I think you all know, Mark is the great gospel of the messianic secret. Right? All through the gospel, Jesus insists that everybody keep his identity as the Messiah, hush hush. Sometimes it's after miracles, or the demons tend to recognize him. We know you are. And Jesus says, so after miracles, Jesus doesn't want the miracles talked up, right? So you see that in chapter 1, 33, 44, chapter 5, chapter 7, chapter 8. There's a great miracle, and Jesus says, but don't go blabbing this around. Just commands the demons in chapter 1, chapter 3. Commands the disciples, even after the transfiguration. That was really cool. Yeah, don't talk about it. And then after, you know, who do people say that I am? And then Peter's, you know, well, Elijah, you know, John. Who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you are, you know, you're the Christ. And Jesus said, right answer. Don't tell anybody, right? And then he will sometimes also give, well, of course, the parables themselves were riddles. We always tend to think that Jesus told parables to clear things up. You know, it's just like a little illustration, you know, it's just kind of nice. That's not why Jesus told parables. In fact, after he told his first parables in Mark 4, and then Mark tells us that Jesus didn't teach anything without teaching parables. And Jesus, of course, his ministry was taking off. And there were so many people gathered along the crescent of the shore that Jesus couldn't find a vantage point on land. So he had to shove off shore in a boat so that everybody could see him. And then he gets out and tells about a farmer and seeds and soils. And Mark says that Jesus finishes teaching, and this is funny, you can miss this. He gets back to shore, and we're told the crowds were gone. It's like, well, where'd they go? They went home going, what the heck was that all about? We missed the football game to come listen to this preacher, and he just didn't make any sense. And the disciples come to him and say, what'd you do that for? You had him in the palm of your hand, Jesus. Why did you do that? And Jesus says, well, let me tell you the truth, gentlemen. The reason I speak in parables is because if I didn't, they'll understand me and repent. And I don't want that. I don't want them to believe the gospel. And they're like, well, that's not what we thought he was going to say. That's what he says. And it's interesting difference between Matthew and Mark. Matthew gives us a kinder, gentler Jesus, right? In Matthew, when this happens, Jesus says, the reason I speak in parables is haughty in the Greek because they don't understand. But in Mark, it's the reason I speak in parables is hina, subjunctive purpose clause, so that they will not understand. And you're going, what in the world? So the parables were not clarifiers. They were befuddlers. They were complexifiers. And then sometimes Jesus gave secret instruction to the disciples. And so I just mentioned some commentators think that the key parable, which unlocks so much of Mark and ties in with this messianic secret, is that parable of the growing seed. Right? That parable of the growing seed, it's unique to Mark. It's one of the few things that is unique to Mark. And it's the mystery of that seed that grows while you're not looking and while you're not sleeping, while you're sleeping and you're not looking. And it grows mysteriously, but it grows. And and it happens. And it goes and it goes and it goes. Which may have been Jesus' way of saying, look, this world is broken and only God can fix it. You can't fix it. We can't fix it together even if we put our heads together. Only God can do it, and he's doing it. Not the way you thought. Right? It's a growing seed whose growth was mysterious and unseen and invisible. But that's happening. That's happening. And that's unique to Mark, and that may be a key to unlocking and interpreting a little bit about what the Jesus in Mark's gospel is up to. Jesus knows, and Tom Long suggested this a while ago, and so did Don Jewell. I'll talk more about Don Jewell in a minute. But it's as though Jesus knew that given the misapprehension among many people as to who the Messiah would be, that if people move toward him too quickly and slap that label on him, they try to force him to be an earthly king, to take on Herod and Pontius Pilate and Caesar, because that's who they were looking for. That's what they thought they wanted. That's the salvation and deliverance they thought they needed from Rome, so they could reestablish a new Israel. And Jesus says, no, I'm going to keep this a secret. You keep it a secret until it's all done, and then we can talk about it because you'll understand some things, and I'll get to that in a minute. So needless to say, also another characteristic of Mark, and you can just line this out, just go through it, is that the misunderstanding of the disciples and Jesus, it goes on and on and on. His family doesn't understand him, right? You get to Mark 3, verse 21. His family comes to bring him home because he's an embarrassment. It's time for the rubber room. Come on. He's out of his mind, they said publicly, of their son, their brother. He's crazy. He's lost it. He's lost it. This is embarrassing. We must put him away. His family doesn't understand him. The disciples don't understand him. We're going to look at Mark 6 in a little while, but after Jesus calms the storm in Mark 6:52, the disciples were amazed, and then Mark says they didn't understand him. They misunderstood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Mark's pretty hard on the disciples. Matthew's, again, it's funny to do Matthew, because there's several passages where Mark says they didn't understand. And then where Matthew will say, well, they kind of understood. Because for Matthew, having knowledge was really important. So Matthew was always nuancing it, including, in Mark, Jesus will say something, And the disciples stare back at him in disbelief. They clearly don't understand. That's what Mark ends. Matthew adds a little part to that same story. They're kind of staring at him, and Jesus says, "Do you understand these things?" And they say, "Yes." So nobody gets Jesus in Mark. I mean, nobody. Nobody gets Jesus in Mark. Jesus himself keeps his identity under wraps. Only at the end, of course. Right? Only at the end is there one person who seems to get Jesus, and who publicly identifies Jesus as the Son of God, and nobody tells him to be quiet for the first time. Who is it? Yeah, the soldier there at the cross, right? Surely this was the Son of God, and nobody comes and says, "Shh, nope, he's dead now. Now it's safe to say. Because now we see what Messiah means. Now we see that it's a suffering servant, that it's sacrifice. That's how God heals the world. Now you can say it. Now you can say it." And then, again, reffing on the late Don Jewell, who used to teach New Testament, I think at Luther Seminary, and then he ended his career at Princeton, and he died very, very young. He did a lot of work on Mark. And he talks about the interrupted resurrection account. I think, as you all know, just about everybody in the scholarly world believes Mark ends at verse 16, verse 8. 9 to 20 were added later by somebody, or maybe a couple different somebodies, who thought Mark messed up. You can't end at 8, so let's help him out here and round this out a little bit. Let's handle a few snakes while we're at it. That was a good idea. But it ends in 16, verse 8, with the women, and it's like a freeze-frame photo, is how I picture it. They're like projectiles coming away from an explosion. They're afraid, they're terrified, they're saying nothing to anybody. And so the last image you get in Mark's gospel are these women like this. That's where we go to dark, right? That's it. And it's like, that can't be it, right? And it's as though Mark wants you to say, wait a minute, Mark, the gospel can't end in a silence. And Mark is off to the side going, got that right. What are you going to do about it? The gospel can't end in silence. What are you going to do about it? You going to go say something? You know they did eventually. We wouldn't hear you writing about it. But what are you going to do about it? The camera swivels back to you. But there's also this curious thing, just in terms of Mark, and again, this is Don Jewell. Before that happens, before we end in freeze frame, and by the way, also the last Greek word is gar, you know, the word for for or because. Now, I'm told by my old former Greek professor, whom I checked this with when I preached on it years ago, that it's not that unusual in Greek to end in a gar. In English, it would be very weird, because it would be like ending with an ellipsis. Terrified, they fled, saying nothing to anyone. For? Because? Apparently, the gar doesn't function that way, but I think it should. But it is like it ends with an ellipsis. But before that happens, the angel says, go to Galilee, and there you will see him. Now, there's all kinds of weird things about that that we never realize, right? Mm-hmm. Galilee was 70 or 80 miles to the north of Jerusalem on foot. That's a hike, right? Jesus was raised near Jerusalem. Why didn't he stick around? I mean, you know, why have to go way up there? Anyway, but what's interesting is they say, go to Galilee, there you will see him. He's the real Galilee and so forth. But as Don Jewell said, in Mark's gospel, where is Galilee? It's Mark 1, verse 14. Jesus went into Galilee. And it's, so go to Galilee, reader, and there you will see him. In other words, go back, reread the gospel. You didn't understand it the first time. Jesus had to keep shushing you too. Now that you've been to the cross and you understand what Messiah means, go back and reread it. And maybe you'll understand it better this time. And of course, that actually creates a never-ending loop. You'll get back to that again. So go back and read it again. anyway, maybe... couple things, and then we'll wrap it up and take some questions. In terms of preaching Mark, obviously we've talked about this, the power of story. Bring out the drama of these stories. Maybe our churches today are lethargical too. Or maybe people are wondering if God's really got power to help them if they're going through a bad time. Either of those two possibilities for Mark's original audience work, and both might be present in our churches at any given Sunday. Some people who are just wondering if God has any real power, other people just, you know, who cares, you know, how's the stock market doing? That's what I'm interested in. Now we serve this powerful Jesus. So bring out the drama. Bring out the power of God, that God is on the move. Tom Long told the story years ago that he was teaching a Bible study class, or a friend of his was, and he was teaching that story from Mark 1 we looked at, and noticed how the heavens were tore open. And the Sunday school teacher said to these teenagers, several of whom looked rather bored, isn't that wonderful that the heavens are tore open? Now we can have access to God. And the most bored-looking kid in freckle-faced red hair in the back row, his head shot up and said to the teacher, that's not what that means. No, what's it mean, the teacher said. That means now God can get at us and nobody's safe. God can get at us. God is on the move, that is, but in good ways. And that's part of the message of Mark as well. Mark may also, through that messianic secret and through forcing us to go deeper, forcing us to go all the way to the cross, Mark may also be the cure for superficiality, which some people think may be the besetting sin of America. Just the superficiality, sound bites, surfacey stuff. Mark forces you to dive deeper. And indeed, as Tom Long once said, one of the ways to read Jesus' quirky saying in Mark 4, the reason I tell in parables is so that they will not understand me. A positive gloss on that is, so they won't understand me yet. I want to drive them deeper. I want them to stay with me longer to learn what you're only finally going to learn in the cross. It's also warnings against a silly putty Jesus and the lure of power. You just can't turn Jesus into whoever you want him to be. And Jesus is not going to save the world through political power or brawn or military might. the way people wanted him to. He's going to go his own way. He's going to go to that cross. And you can't stop him, and you can't try to refashion him now, even after the cross. He is the crucified God, and always will be. And we follow him in the church today, or we don't. But we're not going to do his work in the world if we think we can turn him into who others wanted him to be in the first place. And also that parable of the growing seed, sort of maybe a way of fostering trust in God's way of doing things, that God has got this. So God is powerful. He's on the move. You have to stick with him over the long haul to learn his ways of sacrifice and trust that he knows what he's doing. Let me just end with this, and then we'll take a few questions. And I hinted at this a little bit, getting at what I think might be the heart of Mark. And it's this passage, and this is another example of what I talked about earlier in terms of Jesus going into the wilderness to be tempted in Mark 1. Sort of the heart of Mark, one of my favorite verses, this is from the feeding of the 5,000 in Mark 6. Then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. And so they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. And he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied. Lots of interesting things going on here. Lots of it. I once heard a Bible scholar years ago named Herbert O'Driscoll, who said that individual words in the Bible, if the Bible is like a piano keyboard, individual words are not just like plinking down a C or an E. You plink down one word, they always form chords with other parts of the Bible. They always form chords with other parts of the Bible. And so also here. For one thing, we were told in the setup to the story 3 different times that where Jesus taught these people, remember they followed him out as he had gone away to mourn John the Baptist or whatever. But he, they follow him. And so he teaches them. But we're told 3 times it was a wilderness place. It was Eremos. Eremos, Eremos, Eremos. So if you read like the NIV, they will translate that same word 3 different ways. A lonely place, a solitary place, an isolated place. But they will never say a desert place, which is what Eremos means. Right? They're in the wilderness. They're in a wilderness place. That's the first thing. Second thing to notice is that look up your Bible concordance sometime and just look up your average color word. Purple, red, brown, yellow. It's not there. I mean, there's Bible hardly ever. I mean, you don't go to the Bible to read, and then on that day, Jesus rode upon a slate gray donkey on a dusty brown road under an azure sky as people took green palm branch. You don't get that in the Bible. And yet here we get green grass. We're in a desert place. But now there's green grass. Where else have I read green grass?
Green pastures.
Yeah. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall know. He'll lead me in green pastures. The desert's blooming again, for one thing. And then he has them sit down in groups. In the Greek, this is a hapaxlegomenon, a word that occurs only here and nowhere else in the Bible. And it's the word from which we derive the name of this conference. It's symposia, the plural of symposium. And in Greek world, a symposia was a party characterized by lots and lots of food and lots of drink. And good drink, not Kool-Aid. Symposia were joyful, boisterous, wonderful, happy parties. And that's the word Mark uses here. These weren't just a bunch of glum Calvinists sitting around munching their bread and fish in silence. These were groups of joy and conviviality. The desert is blooming. The Messiah is with them. There's going to be more than enough to eat. There are going to be leftovers because where the Messiah goes, cosmos follows. And if the disciples had picked up on this here, then later in this same chapter when he comes walking to them on the waves, they wouldn't have been terrified and they wouldn't have been amazed when he said, "Peace be still," and the calm was stormed. The storm was calmed. That's an interesting glitch. He calms the storm and they're amazed. And Mark says they shouldn't have been amazed, but that's because they didn't understand about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. They were with the messianic great shepherd of the sheep. So of course he could calm a storm, but they missed it. But stick with him because this is who he is. And that sort of really kind of gets at and some short strokes. And again, in Mark's minimalist style, not calling attention to itself. But when you look at it, it's quite amazing. Thoughts, comments on the 9 minutes we have left? Yeah.
I wonder how you handle, or how you reconcile the one, the Matthew being so that they'll understand, and as opposed to the because
right.
I don't want them to understand.
Right. Well, as I recall, I mean, they're both quoting Isaiah, right? And they're both quoting sort of the commissioning of Isaiah, right? So Isaiah had this terrible job. I want you to go preach to Israel, and nobody's going to listen to you. And that's okay, because that proves that my judgment is correct, right? And there is a little, as I recall in the Hebrew, there's a little ambiguity there in Isaiah as to what that means, preach because they don't understand, or preach to make them not understand. The Hebrew could go either way, so there's a little wiggle room there. But it's also one of those situations, and who knows what the original Aramaic was that Jesus spoke. But it also goes to, I mean, the idea is similar, but it also goes to the different purpose. So for Matthew, knowledge was really important. There shall be no nothing disciples in Matthew. And that's why he's always given the disciples a little more credit for knowing more, because he's trying to get Israel to reappropriate its own tradition to see that Jesus is the Messiah. And you're going to have to know a lot of it. So Matthew was always a little bit more nuanced on those things, because he really wanted to show understanding is really, really important. Mark thought understanding was important too, but was willing to let it wait, all right, until the end, whereas Matthew was trying to... So I can't reconcile them in the sense that one of them is right and one of them is wrong. It's just one of those editorial choices that they made to go with the larger theological themes they were trying to bring out and their different reading audiences. And Matthew had a very different reading audience, and therefore had a very different tactic than Mark did.
But when you're preaching on it, do you make that explanation? Or,
no, don't.
Or like you said this morning, you hope they forget from 1 year to the next.
Yeah, you do. I usually tell my students that, particularly when you're preaching on the Gospels, and particularly the Synoptic Gospels, stick to the Gospel you're in. You've got plenty to do there as it is. Most people aren't all that interested in having the differences between, you know, this account of the healing in Jericho and that account pointed out. Some of them find that academic. And if they don't find it academic, they find it terrifying, because they think it means that the Bible can't be trusted. And, you know, why prop that up? Sometimes you can't avoid it, maybe. Somebody is bound to notice that Jesus cleanses the temple first thing in John's Gospel, and at the end of the other three, somebody's going to ask you, what's that about? In a sermon, you know, in a Bible study or something, or if somebody asks you about it, you need to be ready to talk about it. But in a sermon, I don't do those compare and contrast, particularly where it's going to set off the alarm clocks in some people's hearts. Well, what did Jesus really say? And the answer to that is, he said what Matthew said he said. But Mark had him say something different. Yes, he said what Mark said he said. These are inspired apostles. We trusted the message. So, yeah.
Thanks.
You don't want to be dishonest or pull the wool over anybody's eyes, but you can only do so much in a sermon. And sometimes people get blown out of the water by that kind of thing, and they can't hear anything else.
You talked about preaching the Mark and sandwiches.
Yeah.
Sometimes work well and sometimes don't.
Right.
You want to elaborate that on sort of what you feel like makes that?
Yeah, some of them are just easier to see. So Jesus' family saying he's out of his mind, and the Pharisees saying it's by Beelzebub that he drives out Beelzebub. That's a little bit easier to see. Or the sick girl and the bleeding woman. Some of the ones, and I got a huge list of these from my professor here, Dean Deppe. He loves these things. We've always said you should have opened a Mark and Sandwich shop somewhere. I have to work really hard to see them myself, because they're kind of subtle. And when they're that subtle, you're maybe not going to convince anybody that it's there. But when they're more obvious, like the girl, the dead girl, and the bleeding woman, the family and the Pharisees, some of them are pretty obvious. And you can point them out and say, see what Mark is doing here? He's got two of the same thing. In between, we got something that gets illuminated both directions. When that's relatively clear, because, you know, in sermons you can't, it's like chiastic structures, right? Mm-hmm. Scholars love them, but it takes forever to point them out. And most people in a sermon on a Sunday morning aren't that jazzed about chiasms, right? And it takes too long to explain them anyway, unless it's super obvious or something. But anything that takes a scholarly turn, that takes a lot of airtime out of your sermon, probably is a good thing for an adult Bible study.
Thanks.
not a sermon. But some of the marketing sandwiches are really obvious and cool, and others are more subtle, and I don't know that you can get to it quick enough. Yeah.
I'm just curious about your opinion on the naked man at the end.
Yeah.
I heard that he may be, you know, Mark just narrating himself. But I also heard some appealing theory that it's a symbol for the church just in the garden and leaving Jesus alone, and then meeting Jesus after the resurrection is the angel that appears
present. Yeah. So of those 31 verses that I mentioned are unique to Mark, that's one of them. Right, the young man who flees naked from Gethsemane. Somebody rips off his loincloth. Right. Some people think that's Mark's signing the gospel. That was me. talk about revealing yourself. Others think, right, it's a symbol of the disobedient church, and then maybe the angel, the young man, who's clothed in Easter. There are very few people who know definitively what to make of that. I mean, there's a lot of theories, and mostly a lot of head scratching. Was it Mark signing the gospel? That seems like a stretch. Maybe. And the connection with the angel seems like a stretch. There's just not much to go on. That's the problem, right? It's just this verse. It just kind of comes out of nowhere and goes nowhere. And I think you can probably find as many theories as commentaries as you read. So I've never preached on it. Because I didn't think there's a lot edifying there. But it is, that's one of the very few verses that is nowhere else, and there's probably a reason. I'm not putting that in my notes. But yeah, there are some interesting theories there. Yeah, Doug.
It's risky to ask people to recommend commentaries, but you've referred to Donald Jewell. Are there other folks out there that you find helpful?
Yeah, I mean, Donald Jewell has a little book. It's kind of a commentary. J-U-E-L is his name, J-U-E-L. He's been gone a while now, unfortunately. He had pancreatic cancer, I think. But he's got a little book on Mark. I can't remember the name of it right now. I can see the cover, but I can't. But you'll find it on Amazon. I think it's still in print. There was, in the Word series out of Waco, Texas years ago, there was Gulich started Mark, and he did the first half of Mark, and then he died before he could do the second half. The first half was really good. The second person who finished the second one isn't as good. But Gulich is good, at least through Mark 8:28. And then who did Mark in the Interpretation series? The Interpretation series is almost always good. I can't remember who did it, but that's pretty good. And then offhand, I can't think of any others right offhand. There are some. But Jewel's interesting. And then there are some more recent ones, too, that from the Erdmann's International series. There's a new one. I can't remember who it is, but that's supposed to be pretty good. But, yeah. We do have a couple of, the Center for Excellence in Preaching has a website, cep.calvinseminary.edu, and we have resources and books and recommended commentaries for every book of the Bible. There's probably a couple on there I'm not thinking of right now, but you can look them up. So, thank you.